And I would like to begin with this. 20 years ago tomorrow, we committed to never forget 9/11. So I would like to take a moment of silence to honor our commitment to remember. There were lives lost, hearts broken, and public servants who chose to run in to help in the tragedy instead of away from it. Please take this moment now, this moment of silence, to remember. Thank you, and may we continue to never forget. And we will move into public comment. I would just, first of all, we're going to take the roll. I'm sorry, Carrie, please, thank you.
Chair McAdoo?
Here.
Vice Chair Carter?
Present.
Regent Arescada?
There.
Regent Boylan?
Yes, here.
Regent Brooks?
Here.
Regent Carvalho?
Here.
Regent Del Carlo?
Here.
Regent Dubrava?
Here.
Regent Geddes?
Here.
Regent McMichael?
Here.
Regent Moran? Regent Perkins?
Here.
Regent Tarkanian?
Present.
You have a quorum present.
Thank you, Carrie. And we will now move into public comment. I would just remind each of us that we each have 2 minutes for public comment, and you will see the clock there. We will start with public comment at GBC.
Madam Chair, there is no public comment in Alcoats.
Thank you. We will now ask for any public comment in Reno.
Yes, ma'am. We do have public comment.
Thank you.
Kent Irvin, State President of the Nevada Faculty Alliance. We support vaccinations for faculty, students, and staff as the surest way to return to more normal and safe in-person instruction. Over 1,020 colleges nationally are now mandating vaccines. Our petition to you and the State Board of Health in favor of mandatory vaccinations was signed by over 1,270 members of the NC community. Everyone on campus should be subject to identical science-based mitigation measures. The virus does not discriminate by status. There should be reasonable medical and religious exemptions for both students and employees. Recommendations of the public health experts should be followed regarding testing or accommodations for those who remain unvaccinated. Personally, in my chemistry lecture of 250 students, I have had 9 in quarantine, half of those officially reported, and more are waiting on tests. Masking compliance has been excellent, I'm happy to say, but we are all packed into a lecture hall at capacity. I most fear that a student in my class will have a severe case. In the meantime, I'm doing the lectures twice, once in person where I can use the whiteboard and props and fully engage, and then again to record it for the students in isolation. Anxiety and increased workloads are hurting faculty morale, as is the widespread perception that NC dragged its feet since the Chancellor's statement on May 6th about planning for mandatory vaccinations. I say perception because communication is so important. Faculty are concerned that sufficient testing is still not in place after the August 15th state mandate. If anything, NC has been too complacent in waiting for state or local mandates than implementing only the minimum requirements. Agenda item 13 for more planning is for more planning at this late moment. Please approve it. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Kent. Are there other comments?
No, Madam Chair, that concludes it.
Thank you, Regent Geddes. Do we have public comment in Las Vegas. Thank you.
Doug Unger, President, UNLV Chapter in Southern Nevada Government Affairs, Nevada Faculty Alliance. Thank you, Chair McAdoo, Vice Chair Carter, and distinguished regents for your consideration. Last year, it would have been inconceivable to imagine appealing to this distinguished board to require vaccinations against a deadly disease when for decades mandatory vaccinations for faculty, staff, and students against infections has been sensible and established policy. Such are the times we live in, plagued not only by a god-awful virus, but even more so now by its malevolent twin, disinformation. Disinformation about vaccines and the COVID-19 pandemic spread ignorance, stupidity, illness, and death among the uninformed and gullible. It also serves nefarious individuals who exploit distortions and lies for material or political gain, and in so doing, contribute to the unnecessary deaths of tens of thousands of people. We should look to facts. Our current Nevada infection rate stands at 12.9%. As reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, vaccinated persons show a 2.9% breakthrough infection rate, significantly lower than the infection rate among the unvaccinated. As reported by the Centers for Disease Control, the unvaccinated are 29 times more likely to be hospitalized from COVID-19 than the vaccinated, and the unvaccinated are 15 times more likely to die. These facts are based on peer-reviewed reports and methodologies, and they should speak more loudly than any outcries by the misinformed or misguided to influence the policy decision you will make today. The Nevada Faculty Alliance supports the safest possible workplace environment on our campuses. Students are already subject to a vaccine mandate. We ask you to vote in favor of authorizing policy amendments to require a COVID-19 vaccination for all NSHE employees, better to assure the health and safety of our campus communities when you address agenda item 33. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Unger. Do we have more public comment in the room in Las Vegas? None in the waiting. All right, thank you for that. And Carrie, do we have a written comment submitted?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And so I would ask that you run the clock on these, please. Thank you.
The first comment is from Angela Ash. A UNR alum with a BS in Community Health Sciences and 20 years of NSHE service, I reject the proposal for government to eliminate employee rights to make their own healthcare decisions. Defying your own values, mandating healthcare decisions for others is not respectful, nor is it supportive. It disempowers everyone and fails to be inclusive. It is inappropriate, dangerous, and carries significant unknown liability and risk for everyone. The decision to take a drug documented to include the risk of death and other catastrophic health risks is a private matter between a patient and their physician. When an individual is prescribed a drug, a surgical procedure, or a genetic therapy, they are advised to review the risks and side effects and make an informed decision as to whether the benefits outweigh the risks for their own life. The belief that mandating is the only safe and fully effective solution is untrue. This situation is still evolving with new data daily. No one has all the answers. It takes 3 to 5 years for autoimmune disease to materialize and to be properly diagnosed. 8/30/21, NIH announced a 1.67 million study of reports of inexplicable cessation of periods. Israeli government is now questioning efficacy, researching mRNA vaccines, long-term dangers. August 31st, 2021, a massive randomized study confirmed the efficacy of masks to limit the spread of the virus. September 7th, 2021, the WHO stated COVID will not be eradicated. It will not simply go away with increased vaccination preventative efforts. It will evolve and stay with us like the flu. Nevadans deserve a higher ed system committed to curiosity, who never stop questioning, investigating, and evaluating unknowns. That's 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you.
The next comment is from Erica Nolte. The COVID vaccination should not be mandatory for students and employees. Masks are working and have kept COVID-19 infection cases on campuses low. The COVID-19 vax has side effects: missed periods in women, seizures, tremors, enlarged lymph nodes, etc. The vax is not a one-size-fits-all. The long-term effect of using this vaccine is unproven. Vaccine development takes years. The COVID-19 vaccine was rolled out in far less time. The government is overreaching and has no right to mandate a vaccine upon those who do not wish to take it. If you have taken the vaccine, that is your choice. I, too, have a choice and should not be forced to take this vaccine against my will. Nevadans were told to take the vax. It will prevent COVID. After taking the vax, you can still get COVID. More importantly, after taking the vax, you can still spread COVID. My health is my choice. If you have taken the vax and are protected, my vaccination status is not your concern. Continuing to wear masks works and should be the only requirement. Taking the vax does not stop COVID. Masks do. The next comment is from Aaron Hartling. Stripping people of bodily autonomy and blanket mandates are not the path ahead. The science is showing that the current vaccines do not help protect or prevent a person from the mu or lambda variant, and Delta is quickly evading it. Next is from Emily Sawan. Please require mandatory vaccines for all NSHE staff with very strict limitations on only medical releases. This is for safety, not only for teachers like me who are working on the front lines to educate our future, but for the safety of all our students. Our students have so much power, so much potential, and they are the future of our state. Don't make our students pick between getting a degree and getting sick. Don't make us pick between teaching, between doing what we love, and getting sick. Don't allow us to be exposed to a disease that has unknown long-term health effects and could end up killing us. There are other options, other ways we can all stay safe and work on putting COVID behind us, and that lies in mandatory vaccinations. Please authorize mandatory vaccinations for all NSHE employees. The next comment is from Dana Ryder. I am strongly in favor of the vaccine mandate for staff and faculty. We ought to abide by the same rules that have been set for our students. Moreover, this pandemic will never end unless governing bodies and workplaces create the conditions to end it, notably like they already do with other vaccinations such as MMR and TD-Tdap. Next is from Todd Rucker. Vaccines have been proven again and again the best tool we have in controlling this pandemic. Hundreds of millions of people around the world at this point have taken the COVID vaccines, and their safety has been more than adequately demonstrated. Having a vaccine requirement for all involved in higher education in this state will help us keep our classes in person where they belong. The last comment is from Serena Evans. My name is Serena Evans. I am the policy coordinator for the Nevada Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence, NCEDSV. We want to thank you for the work you're doing following the passage of SB 347. During the 2021 legislative session, we at NCEDSV, along with the Every Voice Coalition and others, worked tirelessly on SB 347 to ensure that the supportive provisions included in the bill would benefit victim survivors in an impactful and meaningful way. The Task Force on Sexual Misconduct at Institutions of Higher Education will be beneficial in enhancing prevention work, providing supportive measures for victim survivors, and making NSHE campuses throughout the state more trauma-informed. You all have done a great job with recruiting and appointing excellent representatives. We look forward to connecting with them and offering our resources and support. In addition to the task force, we appreciate the measures taken by the Board of Regents to adopt and amend the current policy to include an amnesty provision for reporting students and requiring annual training for campus law enforcement relating to the nuances of sexual violence. While these are significant steps, we certainly hope that the Board of Regents and the Task Force on Sexual Misconduct will work to implement all of the provisions laid out in SB 347. Said provisions were carefully thought out and created by student survivors and advocates throughout the state and are proven to be victim-centered and trauma-informed responses that positively impact students who experience these forms of abuse and violence. The Board of Regents must take every reasonable step to enact the entirety of SB 347, including optional portions of the bill. NCEDSB is here to offer support and guidance on implementing these measures. Please utilize our expertise on this matter. Thank you for your time and attention. We look forward to working with you all.
Good job.
That completes the public comment. Thank you.
Good job. You got that last sentence in there. Thank you so much. At this time, I would like to go ahead and take the update on the affiliation with Renown Health, President Sandoval. And then immediately following that, we will break for lunch. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair McAdoo. For the record, this is Brian Sandoval, President of the University of Nevada, Reno. With your permission, I'd like to present Dean Emeritus Tom Schwenk to make the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, President Sandoval. Madam Chair, members of the Board of Regents, Tom Schwenk, Dean Emeritus, University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine. I'm simply here to pass the leadership baton to and introduce Dr. Melissa Piasecki, who is our new acting dean. Dr. Piasecki is a distinguished professor of psychiatry with a long tenure at the University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine. She has a national reputation as a forensic psychiatrist, which is her specialty, and consults widely in very complex legal cases around the country. But she also has a long history with us, first in the Department of Psychiatry and then as Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, responsible for our teaching programs, and more recently as our Executive Associate Dean with a particular responsibility for the implementation of the Renown integration. So she is particularly well-suited to take the baton at this point and to update you on the Renown integration. Dr. Piasecki.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. I would like to start off by thanking Dr. Schwenk for that very kind invitation. I'd also like to thank him for 10 years of leadership at UNR-Med. And it's so appropriate that we're talking about the Renown affiliation this morning because it really is a culmination of his leadership. And he's really positioned the School of Medicine to thrive in the years ahead. So this is wonderful timing. Also, would like to thank the entire board for the support of the affiliation. Following the board's approval in June, you may have heard there was a governor's proclamation of UNR-Med and Renown Affiliation Day. That was on June 28th, and we were so pleased to receive that recognition from the state of Nevada. I've been at UNR-Med for 26 years, and to borrow a phrase from President Sandoval, this really is a generational opportunity. I am so excited to be moving into the acting dean role at a time when we are growing the affiliation. As we reach out to our students that are joining UNR-Med, this is one of the things that I really am excited to tell them about. It's a real remarkable opportunity for the school, and it means a lot for the students and the faculty and the community. I'm going to hit a few of the highlights from the briefing paper that we submitted for today's meeting, and I'll look forward to your questions as well. The affiliation, as you know, represents integrated governance as well as clinical teaching and research activities. And in August, the Renown Board met and President Sandoval joined the board as one of the voting members. The Chief Academic Officer, which as you recall is a role shared with the Dean of the School of Medicine, was also attending that board meeting. The Chief Academic Officer role is a 50-50 role with Renown Health, is a member of senior leadership groups, and as I've transitioned into the acting dean role, I've been active with the leadership of Renown, including their strategic planning activities. And It's been a wonderful opportunity to be in those leadership groups because I see every day more opportunities to collaborate between the two institutions. There's other integrated roles between the two institutions, including research roles, education, shared and collaborative recruitment, and as you'll hear in a little bit, recruitment of academic department leadership that will share the role of division chief leadership at Renown Health. One of the top topics for the School of Medicine right now is the integration of our clinical operations with Renown, and we have a October 1st date for our go live. This includes integration of electronic medical record with Epic, HR, clinical operations, space integrations, training activities, a new physician compensation agreement, and a host of other agreements that are building out the affiliation agreement. I like to think of the affiliation agreement as the blueprint for this new entity that we're building together with Renown. And because of the length of the agreement, I think of it as a forever house. So we're building it carefully and we're building it well. Part of the build includes new work on faculty tracks. So as the affiliation agreement outlined, we're working towards combined and unified faculty tracks. That includes new faculty appointments, changes to faculty and staff roles, and integrated positions. And we're grateful to UNR, HR, and Provost Office for their support of all of that work. We see emerging from this work a clinician educator track and a clinician researcher track. We're working together on the integrated chief chair positions, as I mentioned, and this will be a shared role for academic and clinical leadership. Currently, we have this model in our Department of Pediatrics, and we are seeking to expand this model into other clinical departments. We have a plan for recruitment. UNR will do these recruitments with collaboration and participation of our renowned colleagues, and we've launched the first of these new recruitments for a new chief chair of OB. This will be followed by additional searches in internal medicine, family medicine, and psychiatry. I'd like to say a few words about our clinical research operations. Shortly after the affiliation was approved, our director of clinical research at UNR Med moved into a dual role at Renown Health, and she hit the ground running. There's a large number of clinical trials that are ongoing. And with her role there, we are increasing the research opportunities for our students, our faculty, and our residents. And we are planning the recruitment of a chief clinical research officer. I had the great experience of meeting with Dean Kahn from UNLV Medicine last week. I should mention this is day 10 of being acting dean, and so within the first week it was great to connect with him. And we've already talked about the opportunities for clinical research with the combined clinical research director at Renown reaching out to our UNLV colleagues in clinical research. Graduate medical education, which is the medical education phase between medical school and independent practice where people specialize in different medical specialties, has a special place within the affiliation. We have a GME, or Graduate Medical Education, consortium that includes UNR Med, the VA, and Renown Health. And this consortium is focusing our energies and allowing us to develop processes and supports to grow new residency programs in Northern Nevada. The front burner for new residency growth would be in pediatrics, where we already have identified a potential support from a donor to help us fast track the pediatrics residency. And I would say that the affiliation has really facilitated that support. We're exploring other possible residencies and fellowships to meet the needs of Nevada. With that, I will pause. Thank you for your support again and see what questions you have.
Thank you, Dr. Piasecki. Do we have any questions or comments from the board? Regent Moran?
Thank you, Madam Chair. At Health Sciences, I had to take another matter, but while I have an opportunity, just real quickly, I wanted to say thank you again to our outgoing and long-term Dean Schwenk. Going back to when I first ran for this position, my very first event attended was with him and his wife, who was just such a lovely person, and I enjoyed that evening. It had a Harry Potter theme that I thought was pretty unusual. The culinary experience was pretty cool, too. The dessert was definitely, I guess the best way to characterize it is unusual. But it was a fun night, and it was neat to see all of these future doctors kind of commingling and doing what they do. And so it was a fun time, and I will definitely miss all of the good stuff that you did over all of these years and moving the medical school forward. I also, again, wanted to note my appreciation for how hard you have worked with the folks down here in the South to create a very cohesive medical education system at the public higher education level. So I just wanted to say thank you on behalf of me. And last but not least, I'm looking forward to working with the new dean coming in, Dean Piasecki, obviously very, very experienced and knowledgeable and trained by you. So the apple sometimes doesn't fall far from the tree, and I'm hoping that is the case here. That being said, also kudos on this particular item and moving this project, this strategic partnership and joint venture partnership with Renown forward between UNR Medical School and, again, Renown. As you know, I was a proponent of that earlier when this was brought. I think that the long-term deal that was cut is something that I think is important, and it demonstrates the system and the medical school's commitment to Renown, and it also demonstrates Renown's commitment to us. And so, again, genius work, and I wish you the best, and if you're ever down here in Las Vegas, hopefully you'll look me up, and we can visit. Again, I've really enjoyed working with you, and I would have felt remiss not to say that in the open meeting, Dean Schwenk. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Regent Moran. I think the school is in good hands, including the tremendous leadership from President Sandoval, who's so critical here. But I can't claim credit for treating Dr. Piasecki, but I will claim some credit for helping her come into this in such a strong position.
And Vice Chair Carter.
So a couple of compliments of her comments. I have remember a conversation we had several years ago talking about the importance of pediatrics and the underserved population up there. And I really appreciate the donor coming forward to do the residency there. It's very, very important that we take care of that population. But also want to give my comments about Dean Schwenk as well. I consider him my teacher of the medical world. I came to the board with a lot of expertise on a variety of different things, but medicine was not one of them. So over the last 4 years, I have learned such a large amount of stuff, interpreting how UNLV is going to do stuff, how they split, just everything from how residencies work to graduate medical education. So I know over the last 4.5 years, I've monopolized a lot of your hours there, but you're my teacher of how the healthcare system works, so I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Regent Carter.
Do I have any other comments? Regent Arascata, please.
I'd too like to echo the sentiments of my fellow peers up here. Great job, Dr. Schwenk. Dr. Schwenk, but on the side note, could you please provide us an update in regards to the scholarship opportunities that Renown has agreed to participate with?
Yes, happy to do so. Dr. Piasecki could have as well. The current commitment, as it's written in the affiliation agreement, is for an initial commitment by Renown of $350,000 annually that is being administered by our Office of Student Affairs. We're going to provide some support to entering students, some support to students later in their career, and some support to PA students. It's not just to medical students. We believe it's in everyone's best interest that that amount will grow over time, but there's no specification for that, but there is at least an annual commitment of $350,000 right now.
And the best route for students to apply for those is those scholarships, is that through the schools, is that through school of medicine, through an Allen?
Well, it's not a direct application process. These funds are administered through our overall merit and need-based awards and factored into a number of other scholarship commitments that we have. We have roughly a third or perhaps a bit more of our total tuition burden is supported by scholarships, and this will add to that.
Thank you.
All right. So if there are no further questions or comments from my fellow regents, I will say to you, Dean Schwenk, I will personally miss you, and obviously we will miss you as a whole throughout NSHE, but we are very grateful for Dr. Piasecki stepping in, and we know that you had great influence in that. And I will welcome her with open arms, although she's been here longer than I have. So that's just awesome. So thank you. Thank you for your service. And I'd really like to give him a round of applause.
Thank you, Dr. Floyd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been an honor to work with the board for the past 10 years, and I look forward to great things coming in the future with your support.
Yes. And now, Dr. Piasecki, there may be questions for you. I think we all just wanted to express our deep thoughts. Does anyone have any direct questions for Dr. Piasecki? We don't seem to have any right now, but we know how to get a hold of you. So thank you. Thank you for not really stepping in, but taking this responsibility. We're very grateful for your service in the past and look forward to what you're going to do with us in the future. Thanks so much.
Chair McAdoo, thank you so much.
All right, it is 11:42. We will break for lunch until 12:15. Thank you. Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and reconvene. And wasn't that a delicious lunch? The board staff put all those menus together for us, and the caterer, they've done an amazing job. So thank you to all of you for that. And we will now move to item number 19, President Whitfield.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Hello to the regents, other presidents. This is Keith Whitfield, president of UNLV. Sorry for that short delay. I had it down as 21, so I was scrambling there. I wanted to make sure we were on the right one. But 19 is the status report on the UNLV campus master plan update. So today what I want to do is to provide you with an update on the status of our master plan work. And before I do that, I just wanted to share that today is actually UNLV's 64th birthday. She doesn't look a day over 50. Actually, on September 10th, 1957, on campus was the first classes, and they were held at Maud Fraser Hall. A lot's changed since then, and our future is embraced within our planning in our master plan. Now, you may recall that UNLV last developed major campus master plan updates in 2012 and 2015, with a limited update in 2017. On this basis, we embarked on another major campus master plan update in 2018, focusing mainly on the Maryland campus. Through the COVID-19 pandemic, though the COVID-19 pandemic extended the process, we remain focused on the long view of continuing to plan our campus to be an inviting, inclusive, and supportive environment for our students, faculty, staff, and for the broader community. The bulk of our engagement, outreach, and input process took place between June of 2019 and March of 2020. You might remember something happened around March of 2020. With more technical and focused interactions, it went on through January of 2021. Even with all of that going on, through this time, we engaged with over 15 campus and community master plan committees and work groups and conducted more than 50 presentations, work sessions, town halls, feedback sessions, and engagements with communities. The participation and representation at these forums spanned a wide range of stakeholders, including students, faculty, staff, student government, campus governance organizations, foundation representatives, alumni association representatives, campus operations, like almost everybody. The campus master plan will update and expand our campus development framework for items such as effective use of campus land resources, expanding the quality and extent of campus facilities, amenities, and spaces for academic and research activities, student and campus life, housing, community engagement, athletics, recreation, campus operations, signage and wayfinding. So what I'd like to do with that introduction is actually turn it over to Dave Frommer, who serves as our Associate Vice President for Construction, Planning, and Real Estate, to walk you through a draft of our comprehensive plan. David?
Thank you, President Whitfield. For the record, I'm David Frommer. I'm the Associate Vice President for Planning, Construction, and Real Estate. It's good to see you, Chair. If I push the button, I'm really
honest. Thank you. Oh. That really helps. So thank you. Good to see you, Chair McAdoo, and members of the board. For the record, I'm David Frommer, the Associate Vice President of Planning, Construction, and Real Estate at UNLV, and here to present some information related to the status of our campus master plan update. So with that, I'll go ahead and go through a few slides. Hopefully I can figure out how to click through. Okay. So to speak a little bit about campus engagement, and President Whitfield went through quite a bit of that, we undertook a very broad and extensive process of connecting with both our campus community, students, faculty, staff, division representatives from different areas of campus, as well as external stakeholders, be them alumni or trustees or allied organizations and municipalities, to make sure that we got a good broad round of input into the campus master plan, both in terms of goals, but also in terms of status and progress reports to see if we were going in the right direction and reflecting what our stakeholders were telling us. So in terms of the vision, we did establish some plan principles. These tie into the UNLV Top Tier 2.0 goals, as well as the ENSHE strategic goals, and really are a representation of how we can translate these into the physical environment of campus. So just to highlight some of the titles, things like embrace UNLV's roles as a top-tier institution, foster an unparalleled student experience, celebrate diversity, achieve preeminence in health sciences, advanced research growth and partnerships, engage with our community in Southern Nevada and Nevada, promote stewardship, and enhance connectivity and institutional identity. Some very, I think, worthy goals. And out of this came some big ideas in working with our master plan firm and the feedback from the stakeholders. The big ideas are including reinforcing the campus structure in terms of how the campus is organized. We have some very beautiful spaces on campus and organizational elements and facilities. We have some areas that are not yet well developed but present great opportunities. So how can we take advantage of those opportunities to reinforce and enhance how the campus is organized, how you get around, how things work together. strengthen the campus core. We have a really wonderful campus core around Lead Library and Hospitality Hall and the classroom building complex, Harder Classroom Complex. How can we further reinforce the center of campus, kind of the core of where things happen, and a lot of students and faculty and community engage, among many other facilities such as performing arts and other academic research community programs. Connecting campus neighborhoods, and we have some neighborhoods that are well established on campus. Some of them are referred to by interesting terms over by the engineering and health sciences north part of campus. We hear that referred to a bit as the dark side of campus. I think it's because there are so many trees that provide such nice shade that some students call it the dark side. Also, I think, particularly I'm an architect, so I had this experience. Architects and engineers sometimes during the colder months will wear, a black trench coat or something. I have to wonder if that's like, the Matrix dark side or something like that. Enhancing and creating places for people, that's what campuses are really all about. How can we create great spaces, great facilities for people to engage in academic research, community, fine arts, performance, cultural activities, and then defining campus edges and gateways, which is something we work on continually to how can we make it better in terms of how UNLV presents itself to the community and how do we define ourselves and kind of create that image and that relationship with our community. So in terms of the development framework, you'll see a slide here with opportunities, and really the items in kind of that tan color show all of the opportunities we feel still exist for future campus development and redevelopment. So a lot of land on campus that we could redevelop. We're at the point now where not many development opportunities don't have kind of an impact. It used to be that we had some sites that really had nothing on them and were easy to redevelop. I think we're at the point now where a lot of what we do have an impact of maybe demolishing a low utilization building that's aged and in need of replacement, or a surface parking lot that provides parking space but could be utilized to a higher density use. So still an amazing amount of opportunity to develop the campus, but we have to be thoughtful about how we deal with the loss of function or an existing facility that may be incorporated into a new development. And then the long-term framework, and I'll get this a little bit more into a slide of districts and neighborhoods, but really an opportunity to further develop what we consider a medium density campus. We're certainly not a campus of 10, 15, 20 story high-rise buildings. Our buildings and the feel of campus that we've gotten a lot of feedback are is really kind of a mid-density campus in terms of our facilities. Science and engineering building or Greenspun Hall or the Lead Library are probably some hallmark facilities among others that show, facilities in the 3, 4, 5 story range that have a very nice kind of urban campus presence, create great spaces, and also utilize land to a higher density level versus a lot of 1 and 2 story buildings that may be lower utilization and not create kind of the spirit of the campus environment folks are looking for. So in terms of campus districts, one of the items that we're looking at is how do we define the campus and make it more kind of understandable, legible, and kind of identifiable to people who come on campus. So this is really the idea of creating campus neighborhoods. I kind of like the term neighborhoods in addition to districts because I think we all fundamentally understand what a neighborhood feels like in terms of people and landscape and buildings and amenities and, food service and all of those things that happen in very nice neighborhoods. So we have Cottage Grove is, again, these are working terms, University District, the core, where a lot of things happen in the center of campus, the Tropicana area, the Thomas and Mack, Harmon, which has a lot of our athletics and events facilities, as well as Flamingo, one of our main entries. So a few examples of what these neighborhoods or districts could look like. This is a proposed vision of the core district or neighborhood. You'll see Lead Library in the center there and a whole lot of development around it. To the west of Lead Library or to the left is an area where we have a lot of kind of service functions for campus, our parking office, our facilities management offices and yards. really a great opportunity to develop another campus center right next to our library, which is really such a prominent and well-utilized and really enjoyable facility, creating a new quad with campus facilities around that. The Harmon Avenue entrance on the west side of campus coming in and really creating more of a pedestrian experience there where it's really more of a welcome as opposed to right now. It's kind of littered with parking and kind of a little bit inconsistency. That's, again, a great opportunity to create really a wonderful campus corridor and really a remarkable medium density entry to UNLV. And then that kind of pink shade structure you see just to the right of Lead Library, we really see that as a central quad opportunity. We used to have North Field on campus where the Hospitality Hall went. That was a great site for Hospitality Hall. It's a beautiful facility. It's become kind of a living room for campus in some ways because it's enjoyed not just by hospitality students, but also all students. We see the opportunity to restore that kind of North Field central quad right next to the library, right in the center of campus, so that you really have that central moment on campus where everyone can gather and becomes kind of that heart of the campus. So some imagery of what that might look like. The library you'll see is kind of center left. That pedestrian landscape corridor is right in the center. That heart of campus is to the bottom of the slide with that multicolored shade structure. And, you know, we can never forget where we are. We are in Southern Nevada. We are in Las Vegas. The Strip is our neighbor. The Strip is our background. I think this image just shows how remarkable that relationship is. And, you know, if you've been to Hospitality Hall in the top floor where the kitchens are, it's really a wonderful connection that we want to emphasize and create more of that connectivity and more of that relationship with our community, with the Strip and other districts around campus. Another image, this is looking over by the Alumni Walk, which is just next to the Harder Classroom Complex. Again, that's where Central Desert Complex facilities are located. They're kind of single-story facilities. I was here in 2004 when they were put in. They were temporary. Sometimes temporary on campuses is not as temporary as you once imagine, but we see this as an opportunity to develop some really great core academic and student facilities to create, again, that center core of campus. Then the Tropicana District, this is where our housing exists and the parking garage down to the south, which you see there's the expansion we just started on. The School of Architecture is down there, and then some of the student services facilities. So again, an opportunity to redevelop and create more density and more of a neighborhood feel as opposed to buildings that kind of stand on their own. Again, some more imagery. That's right next to the rec center. Again, you can see how that can really, we have the opportunity to create a very vibrant neighborhood with some dining, some expanded housing with our housing partners, and again, creating more of a neighborhood than exists today, even though there are some great neighborhood features there today. And then the University District neighborhood. This is the Maryland frontage. We've had a lot of planning go into buildings like a replacement for Grant Hall, a new business college building. We've looked at concepts of expansion of the student union services, and we've also been acquiring, with your approval and support, properties on the east side of Maryland Parkway, and we're starting to look at opportunities to how Maryland Parkway can be more of a connector than how traditionally it's been more of a divider, and how can we bring that community feel together. And I know the president has spoken many times to us about the importance of creating a university district and further enhancing our connection to the community. So this is kind of a front door view of that potential new business college building and what you might see coming into the campus with that development. So again, a much different kind of perspective on UNLV's presentation to the community and how we relate and interact with our community in terms of our campus and our physical facilities. And then just wanted to speak for a quick moment on wayfinding and signage concepts. Part of the master plan was looking at how do we create a UNLV signage program, a brand. It's been a bit inconsistent, you know, over years. Different things are done and it kind of grows organically. We're actually in the process now of working with our foundation trustees, who have been very supportive of this and have provided a lot of assistance in terms of how do we create families of signage and branding so that the university has a more consistent kind of image to its community and things work together as opposed to the hodgepodge sometimes that occurs over the years of different things popping up. So here's a kind of plan diagram showing some major gateway locations for signage, the heart of campus signage with a landmark signage. The landmarks are indicated as L's. Entry gateways, major landmarks over by the frontage where you see Thomas and Mack, and also on Harmon West, again, our strip face. So how can we, again, have more of a consistency of our signage and branding and connect to our community? So that concludes the presentation, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions, and I know they may come to myself or President Whitfield. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Madam Chair. Regent Moran, and then Regent Boylan, please. Thank you.
Sure. Would you like me to go first, Madam Chair?
You may go first.
Okay, thank you. Just a couple of quick thoughts that I had in my notes when I was reading the materials that had been provided. One question that I had was with regards to the 42 acres, and I noticed that in your short and long-term planning, I noticed that that was not accounted for. Do you have any ideas? Has that been any way performed out in terms of what you'd like to eventually and inevitably end up seeing on that site? Or is it available for sale? What are we doing to monetize that expensive piece of property?
You know, thank you.
I was hoping that a stadium would be placed on it, quite frankly, but Southwest Airlines said that they can't get planes over a 300-foot building, which kind of scares me because how are they getting over, you know, 10,000-foot mountains? Anyway, go ahead.
No, that's a great question, and thank you for that.
I'm going to keep driving, I think. Go ahead.
You know, we didn't focus on the 42-acre site with this plan opportunity. It's still very much in our consciousness, in our mind. It was a strategic acquisition. The ability to acquire 42 acres in this area is not a common one. You know, we are thinking about how we look at that site, and I think there's a few strategies that we've thought about in addition to the master plan update we did in 2017 that had it more as a campus village opportunity. You know, one is does that asset make more sense to generate revenue, whether it's sale or lease, to invest in other campus priorities within the Maryland corridor, which is something we've had on our mind, or is it important to keep that asset for university development in that site? So we haven't yet concluded on that yet, but I think, you know, we've thought about it as, is it an asset where we could use, if we don't need that development space right away, is there a way, whether monetizing that asset, sale, lease, some other approach, that we could use that to invest in other areas of campus development that are much closer to the core of campus and the Maryland Parkway and University District Corridor? And President Whitfield, I don't know if you'd like to add to that.
Yeah, he saw me squirming. Chair, to Regent Moran, through you. I will say you should feel sorry for Dave. They did a bunch of work, and then I came in, and I started messing everything up. And I think it's because I was convinced by what I was presented that Maryland Parkway is a little bit more of where our focus should be as we think about even one of the things that we didn't talk very much about is that we've been designing it in, like, L's and where the main part of campus is and where the main action is and even where some of the future growth is, and there's not a lot of future growth out there. Actually, if you look at the 42, one of the problems is that there's a big space in between. So it doesn't allow any contiguous sort of building. But I think much to what Dave said, and he said it so much better than I can say, we are looking at and trying to think about how strategically we might be able to use that. It might be that we could make some great partnerships, both with the airport, who has approached us, as well as other entities who might be interested in it. But as we think about where our future is and where our future actions are for other research buildings, academic buildings, whatever, we've thought about much more in terms of that Maryland Parkway corridor. One of the other things that's been fascinating is that we have two different commissioners for our area, and both of them are interested in designating that as a university district. so that it would be an area, again, where you would kind of get that feel. I mean, that's what was great in Dave's presentation, is that you get there's going to be a certain kind of feel, whereas right now, I think a lot of people feel it's a flow-through, whereas versus a place, and we want to make it as a place because it's our home.
Gotcha, gotcha. Madam Chair, do you mind if I cover two other little small things? Okay. So the other thing that I had, just a point to make, which I like, I haven't really worked with you much, President Whitfield, but I've kind of been watching what you've been doing, and obviously we get information in the newspaper and then through the community, but I think everyone that has been around long enough knows my fondness for Len Jessup, both professionally and as a friend. You know, in my humble opinion, Len started a really, really a great mission, and I was sad to see that he wasn't able to, you know, capitalize and finalize that on behalf of all of us. But I will say I've gotten along with all leadership at UNLV over the course of the last 4 or 5 years. I thought Marta was a fabulous president as well. But it's nice to see in your plan, Dave, also, and I know you were on that team anyway, so you get it intimately. I was very pleased to see that a lot of the stuff that Len had really pushed forward, it looked like you were reassembling and reconsidering and even moving forward with a lot of the ideas in terms of articulation of the site. And where you were putting different things, and whether it's the student corridor or where the hospitality corridor is. And so I'm really happy to see that because, you know, Len always used to say that you got to create that campus. You got to have to make it a destination where people want to go and spend time, not just go there to take classes, but to go there to socialize and to enjoy each other's company and be around each other and share ideas and whatnot. So I'm really glad that you're doing that, and I'm looking forward to working with you on a more regular basis as things move forward. The other thing I was going to just quickly point out, too, is it's interesting that you bring up the fact that UNLV has a 64-year anniversary, and I wanted to go to UNLV, but my mom and dad wanted to get rid of me. So they started off by evicting me from their house, and I ended up going to Arizona State. But my father went to, it was Nevada Southern before it was UNLV. I'm sure you probably have researched that, and you know that as well, President. But, you know, it's just a great institution, and to see some of the elevations that have been presented in your presentation, incorporating the, you know, the landscape of the city, the cityscape, is really, really cool. And it's starting to look more like what Reno's campus looks like. And I like the way it looks. It has a really good feel up there. And I'm just happy to see that it seems like UNLV is starting to feel a lot like that too. And it looks like you're definitely moving in the direction of creating a really cool open space environment where people can have fun, not just learn. And I think that's important because I think 50% of the battle is just getting people to the institution. But I appreciate that. And Madam Chair, thank you for letting me take the time to go through some of my thoughts and observations.
Thank you, Regent Moran. And now Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure. I appreciate it. I was at UNLV the first time in the early 80s, and I've seen all the changes, and I think I really like them. It's awesome what they're doing. I had two simple questions, really simple. It might be answered in the next thing about the boring company loop station at UNLV. I didn't see anything in these diagrams, or did I miss something? Was it shown where that's going to be in the planning and the pictures that you had? Very nice, very nice. I really like them, but I didn't see anything about that station. Did I go to sleep or something?
Regent Boylan, thank you for the question. We developed the master plan before the boring company opportunity had come up, but I think what we've been generally thinking about, if there's an opportunity, it may make sense to kind of coordinate that with things like Thomas and Mack and the events facility area in terms of high capacity transit from that perspective, if that winds up being feasible. I will also share that, you know, there is a pretty significant transportation element and a parking and transportation master plan that takes into account things like RTC and their mass transit, and they're proceeding with their bus rapid transit project on Maryland Parkway that's intended to tie down to the medical district, as well as how do we accommodate bikes and vehicles and pedestrians. So all of those are definitely part of the conversation and part of the solution for getting people to and from campus. We can't rely solely on any one technology or any one mobility system.
Sure, I understand that. Thank you so much. Now, the other thing I had, and this is really a simple thing, and I'm sure your architects and everybody have thought of this. UNLV is highly prone to flooding. And last year, year before last year, I think students were even, you know, going around in wee little dinghies and boats and all that stuff. So it's something that you don't think happens there, but I myself have walked in knee-deep water long ago. I wouldn't do it now. When you're young, you're stupid. I think, sorry, not everybody, just I'm just saying it for myself. No other young person get offended by that. But have you looked into that, and have you got a special plan, you know, while you're building all this to watch out for that flood?
Thank you, Regent Boyle and David Frommer, again, for the record. That is a part of the campus master plan consideration. One of the projects that actually Clark County is working on right now with the Regional Flood Control District is to the west of campus on Paradise Road, the northeast corner of northwest corner, rather, of Paradise Road and Tropicana. They are in the middle of engineering a detention basin there. That, if completed, would go a long way to help with those flood control and drainage issues, because the intent is to pick up a lot of that water that runs from west to east, detain it before it hits campus, and that would help us just deal with the water that falls on the campus itself versus the tributary flow from the west. We also have other strategies. Certainly where we set the floor levels of buildings is very important for flood control. But yes, the flood control has been an issue, and working with our regional partners, we see some opportunities to make that better and help to make that less of an issue.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's enough from me.
Thank you, Regent Boylan. Are there any other Vice Chair Carter?
Just really quick, do you have a transportation plan? Will that also have like Uber, Lyft, kind of some planning in there for drop-off zones, or is that something as well?
Yes, thank you for the question, Regent Carter. We've established that these entry gateways, like at Cottage Grove and Tropicana and West Harmon, the idea is to have kind of hubs at each entry. Included in that would be drop-off and pick-up for the transportation sharing network companies. So the intent is to have kind of rally points around campus where there would be signage, you'd enter, there would be a place for drop-offs for people who were just dropping off family members, or for the transportation network companies to also drop off. So that is part of the transportation element, yes. Thank you for that question.
Regent Carvalho and then Regent Arascata, please.
I'll try to make mine quick, but in the same vein as transportation, Mr. Frommer, I see that on page 10, the long-term framework, appears that parking structures are towards the outskirts of the university area, and I see that at least in one place now where you have a parking field near the student union, there's going to be a student unit expansion taking away parking spaces. So, one, are you creating more parking spaces with these parking structures? And two, I just have a concern about accessibility for students and staff and faculty who need maybe parking closer. I'm sure you'll have accommodations for them, but I don't necessarily see that on this plan.
Thank you, Regent Carvalho, for that question. part of the premise of the campus master plan, and this has been something we've consistently worked on over the years, is knowing that we can't have all of these surface lots distributed in the interior of campus, is to try to kind of consolidate around the perimeter of campus parking and higher density structures, but also providing accessible paths from those structures. And typically the law will require you to locate accessible parking very close to the path that gets you closest to the building. We do have provisions like in the Harmon West corridor, whether it's to get to the museum in the center of campus or if it's for accessibility measures, to have a drop-off in that area even if there's not parking there. I think it's a tough balance because we absolutely want to have a completely accessible campus, and the law requires us to develop our facilities in concert with ADA and other standards for accessibility. We also want to try to minimize the conflicts we have between vehicles and pedestrians, particularly in that kind of central core of campus, because I think most people expect when they're on campus, and they really look forward to the experience of being able to be among the academic buildings, walking between different functions and uses, and not have to navigate kind of going across a lot of cars that are traversing through the center of campus. So that's the balance we think is hopefully the right balance. I'm certainly happy to talk about that or look at that further, but I think the idea is, how do we get people very close to the core around that perimeter, provide great accessible paths and great places to walk with landscaping and shade, but also provide the experience in the center of campus where students and faculty aren't having to navigate their way around cars for all those conflicts and safety reasons.
Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Arascata?
Easy question. What do you currently, how many buildings do you have in current construction right now?
I would say current construction on the Maryland campus between new buildings and major renovations, we probably have in the range of 6 to 8.
Wow. That,
yeah. So the engineering building, we have 3 former EPA buildings in renovation right now. We have the Tropicana parking structure under construction, so that's 5 major ones right there. I'm probably not thinking of a couple off the top of my head. Yeah, MEB at the Shadow Lane campus, which, again, very prominent building. But, yeah, probably in that range of 6 to 8 in the Maryland campus of major new ground-up or renovation projects.
Wonderful. Great progress. And the financing for the, or the funding for each of these is coming from?
The million-dollar or more question. I think as we lay out the master plan and look at these opportunities, it's going to be a mix of sources. It'll be a mix of philanthropy, potentially state support. If it's a revenue-generating activity like the parking, revenue activities, you know, there are all kinds of strategies out there for public-private partnerships, or how do you monetize facilities with operating partners. Certainly with food service, sometimes there's partnerships with food service entities or concessionaires. So I think it's going to be all of the above and probably more as we learn new strategies to finance capital facilities.
Wonderful. And on a compliment side, I'm on your website looking at these also. From a few years back with the lead library to the new med school. Good stuff, you guys. Have going. Great stuff going on down here.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I noticed that all the signage was for the outside of the campus. How about navigating within the campus? Is that going to be addressed?
Yeah. Regent Perkins, great question. And I know sometimes people struggle in the interior of campuses. Part of the signage package is a whole new series of building identification signs, wayfinding signs, not only for the perimeter. There's another diagram that perhaps I can bring to a future presentation. I want to say there's something like 300 locations of signs we've identified among the entirety of the campus. And we've done some test mock-ups. So at 2 of the former EPA buildings, we've mocked up signage to show the new standard. We also did it at our student affairs maintenance facility. We did it at the new food pantry, and we're going to be doing it at the graduate art studio at the southeast corner of Harmon and Maryland. But the intent is we're going to replace pretty much all of the campus signage, both perimeter but interior, for wayfinding and building identification as well.
Excellent. And is it also going to be digital? I know part of the campus is on Google, but when you're walking on campus, is there going to be something that lets people know that? Like you can, you know, it's on your phone basically.
Oh, in terms of an app or some kind of, you know, that's a great question. I know that there is a mapping app that our IT folks have developed now. That's something I will follow up on to see how we can coordinate among the use of personal technology with the wayfinding. I know we hadn't planned like the digital kiosks outside because a lot of times they're hard to read, they're hard to maintain, they're very expensive. You got to replace them often. We do have some of those digital signage inside of buildings, so once you get in, you can view what's in the building or in the campus directory. But I'll follow up on that point about how do we tie it into the campus technology for users.
Thank you.
Of course.
Great answers.
Okay, I don't see any other questions from the Regents. Thank you very much for the presentation. I liked the word neighborhood, by the way.
I thought it
looked neighborly, and it reminded me of students coming home, because when you go to your neighborhood, you're going home.
Absolutely.
So I like that. Thank you. And President Whitfield, we will move on to the Boring Company Vegas Loop Station at UNLV.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, Regents, and fellow presidents. So in June, UNLV was contacted by the Boring Company to open discussions about the possibility of including a station at the UNLV campus to be a part of the Vegas Loop. Even though discussions and analysis are very preliminary at this point, I wanted to inform you about the potential collaboration opportunity that this poses. There will be public meetings and media attention on the proposed Vegas Loop in the coming months. The Boring Company submitted materials to Clark County in early August that may be agendized at future board meetings of the county commissioners. A Vegas Loop station at UNLV would embrace connectivity for UNLV students and campus visitors along an approximately 30-mile corridor connecting to and from destinations along the Vegas Loop. The slide deck in your reference material provides additional overview of what that Vegas Loop actually might look like. I'm here today because I wanted to assure you that UNLV will not enter into any such agreement lightly. And if, after extensive analysis, UNLV and TBC, the Boring Company, determine that an agreement is mutually beneficial, detailed terms and conditions would be negotiated and brought to the board for approval. Though we're very early in our discussions, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you have, as well as my colleagues, Gene Vock and David Frommer behind me. Thank you.
Do I see any questions? Oh, Regent Perkins.
Well, actually not. Thank you, Madam Chair. No, actually not a question, just a comment. I remember having this discussion about 2 years ago with when I first came on board, when I first heard that they were going to do a stop at the airport between the convention center and the airport. And I'm like, well, where's UNLV stop? And I talked with Dr. Miana about it, and so I'm glad to see this is, you know, on the board and coming forward, because it's really a great opportunity for UNLV.
And Chair, if I might respond to you, Regent Perkins, through the Chair, Keith Whitfield, President of UNLV. What I found interesting was when I started, I asked the same question. I actually saw some of the technology. If you want to see on my phone, I've got pictures of the one. If you haven't been to the convention center, it's incredible. But that is like one of the super centers. What we would be looking at is something that would be far less costly, because that's what happened when I came here. They were saying, you know, a ridiculous number, and I said, well, that's not us. But two, this connects with the previous conversation as we think about Maryland Parkway. And one of, I think, you know, it's not the place, but one of the primary places that we're thinking about is kind of an edge of where the Tropicana Garage is, where Thomas and Mack is. That gets us very close to that Maryland Parkway entry point from Tropicana onto Maryland Parkway. What's been great is that, one, the price point is far lower, even the early discussions, and we do have a limit on what we're willing to try to engage in that and try to absorb that. But even more importantly is that we've discussed these preliminary possibilities with the RTC, And that's changing the way that they're thinking about what Maryland Parkway might look like, because you've got another place that adds to mobility in the area. So nice timing that all of this is kind of coming together at this point in time, but we'll see what happens in terms of the possibilities that they lay out and discuss with us.
Thank you. Regent Carvalho, did you have your hand up, or you were trying to tell me? Thank you. I need all the help I can get. Thanks so much. Any other questions? Thank you for the presentation. And now we will move to item 21, the North Campus background information and status update.
That's me again.
I know it. We're glad you're here.
Thank you, Chair and Vice Chair, Regents, fellow presidents. Keith Whitfield, president of UNLV, for the record. We have two items related to the UNLV North Campus to present to you today. In this item, this first item, I'll provide you some background information and context for recent progress regarding the North Campus site. As a part of the federal legislation signed into law by President Obama on December 19, 2014, UNLV was granted the ability to acquire 2,085 acres of vacant land located in North Las Vegas. The legislation outlined conditions for use of the land, including that it must be used for educational and recreational purposes that are consistent with the Recreation and Public Purposes Act. The land was part of the former Nellis Air Force Base Gunnery Range, and UNLV is working with the Army Corps of Engineers to complete the necessary remediation of that land. The Army Corps has procured $22 million to complete this remediation process. UNLV must also begin the conveyance process, starting with the Chancellor on behalf of UNLV executing a letter of intent with the BLM to begin the conveyance process. We will discuss this further in the following agenda item, but the remediation of the land is anticipated to be completed by the end of 2023. Our goal is to finalize the land transfer at approximately the same time as remediation. In order to meet this goal, UNLV needs to engage the BLM as soon as possible to finalize land conveyance, since this process can take 24 to 36 months to complete. UNLV will be required to cover the administrative costs to complete that conveyance process. Now, I do want to point out, I think he's still here, as you can imagine, as you've heard, this has been a long-running process that we're hoping to see the end of in our foreseeable future. But I do want to acknowledge that Mike Wixom, are you here, Mike? Just wanted to acknowledge he was critical in getting this process started. And so I think, yes, if you would, a round of applause for him. We're anxious to see if we can bring his hard work to fruition here in our foreseeable future. Since this is just an information item, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. And then we can, if not, we can roll into the next one, which talks about that letter of intent.
Regent Carter.
I do have a question on the conveyance. I know that there's a parcel for GBC and CSN as well. I didn't know if it would be appropriate to ask the progress or timeline or how those are going as well.
This is General Counsel Joe Reynolds. Yes, it's within the, I think, contemplated with the overall agenda item.
So is there an update from CSN or GBC on their acreage?
President Hellens, we will ask you to entertain that question once CSN has answered. Thank you.
Oops, sorry. Good afternoon, Patty Charlton for the record, campus VP and provost and also oversight of facilities. For the Northwest Campus parcel, which was identified in the legislation as well, we actually received the BLM transfer already. We have a master plan that was actually brought before this board in 2017. And so we're working on that initial advanced planning to move to construction on building one.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I ask? The question?
Yes, Regent Boylan, please. Is it for CSN?
It's for President Whitfield.
Okay, yes, perfect. Ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. President Whitfield, sir. I Just one question, and I'm sure your people, others will have looked into this, but and Regent Brooks can also confirm, when you have a gunnery range and you have all kinds of things coming down there, there's a tremendous amount of pollution and very toxic pollution. So has this been looked into, and who will be responsible for taking or cleaning up that pollution, besides there being bad, the good stuff? But who would be responsible for that? It's just something I forgot to ask you when we last spoke. Do you have someone?
Let me have David Frommer provide the details. But as I mentioned, part of that remediation process, which is being covered by the Army Corps of Engineers, it's $22 million. He can provide you with some of the details of that, but I assume that that's going to be written in. That's in part why that the cost of that remediation is so high. David, can you provide details?
Of course, President Whitfield. For the record, David Frommer, UNLV, Regent Boylan, thank you for the question. Yes, part of the process and part of the withdrawal language was that NSHE and UNLV would not take title to the land until it was remediated. And the U.S. Army Corps has been a fantastic partner. We've worked with the Nevada Department of Environmental Protection and others. The U.S. Army Corps has undertaken various scoping studies and undertaken solicitations, and that $22 million that President Whitfield mentioned is for that remediation. So that is a responsibility of the federal government to remediate the land as part of their formerly used defense site program. And UNLV and through NSHE would not intend to take title to the land until that remediation is complete. Currently, roughly projected in 2023. And I would like to note we have Cherie Garrity, our executive director of real estate here at UNLV, and Cherie has been working on this project and very closely with the U.S. Army Corps and other stakeholders for the past 15 years or so, pretty much her entire career at UNLV, and she has developed just wonderful relationships with those folks and has really been a key stakeholder in helping that process along and continue in a very good fashion.
Well, so one more question. I really would appreciate it if the young lady could give me some information when she can on the pollutants that would have to be removed, because they take many years, they do, to even if you clear them up, the land is really quite useless. But I'm sure with all the new technology that's come out, we'll be all right. So if she could, then a wee bit of information on how we take care of it.
Thank you, Regent Boylan. Yes, we can produce the reports. The Army Corps has produced that scope to what the remediation is, and they did a lot of sampling, a lot of site investigation, so we can get that information to you through NSHE.
Thank you. You are too kind.
Thank you for the question and the answers. And President Helens, if we could have you come to the microphone to answer for Patrick's question about GBC, please.
Chair McAdoo, this is Sonia Seibert.
Oh, thank you, Sonia.
Good afternoon. Sonia Seibert, Vice President for Business Affairs, Great Basin College. And we are continuing to pursue the development of the land for a new Pahrump campus. It was presented as a capital improvement project for planning during the 2021 session. However, it did not go through for the governor's recommended budget. And so we are currently pursuing other avenues of funding to do the planning of that master plan development of that land in Pahrump.
Thank you. Do you have any further questions, Vice Chair Carter?
No, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Sonia. All right. Thank you for that information. And President Whitfield,
I
said, we're glad you're here.
One more, Chair, one more.
Thank you.
So to the chair, vice chair, regents, fellow presidents, Keith Whitfield, president of UNLV for the record. So now what I'd like to do is request approval of a letter of intent to be sent to the BLM to request to begin the land conveyance process for the North Campus site. Under the terms of the federal legislation, NSHE and UNLV are required to pay all administrative costs and expenses for environmental, wildlife, cultural, or historical resources studies needed to complete the conveyance process. Submitting this LOI to the BLM now will allow us to finalize the remediation and land conveyance activities, hopefully in a concurrent manner. This is important because, as I said previously, that BLM process does take a considerable amount of time. With that, I request your approval of the LOI, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
And I want to put on the public record that that letter on approval will be agenda item 22. That's what we just addressed. And there's a question from Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's to Chancellor Rose. I see that in the report there's no recommendation, and I was wondering if the Chancellor recommends this.
Chair McAdoo, to you through to Regent Geddes, recommend approval.
I would make such a motion.
I'll go ahead and second that.
Okay. Motion by Regent Geddes, second by Regent Moran. Are there any questions? Regent Carter.
Don't have a question, but we'll get to hear my disclosure. I was previously a student in the gaming innovation course at UNLV, where I developed a casino game. If that game is marketed and sold, I will be required to pay UNLV in the form of shared royalties pursuant to a standard contract that all students in the course are required to sign. I will receive no remuneration from UNLV. I disclose this relationship under NRS Chapter 281A, as recommended by the Nevada Commission on Ethics. As this is the first UNLV item, and all the rest of the UNLV items don't affect my interest, I will be voting on all of those items with advice from counsel.
Thank you. Regent Brooks?
I just have one question. President Whitfield, can you please tell us what the proposed costs are for the conveyance process?
It's thought to be $50,000, but I will say that it's possible that that could go a little bit higher, but that's what we estimate it to be.
Okay, thank you.
I don't see any further questions or comments. So all those in favor, vote aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Vote no. I vote aye as well. The motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we will move to agenda item number 23, the handbook revision, the policy against discrimination and sexual harassment, Senate Bill 327 and Senate Bill 347, and it will be for possible action.
Good afternoon, Chair McAdoo, Vice Chair Carter, members of the board, Chancellor Rose, institution presidents, and faculty and student leaders. For the record, my name is Tina Ressam. I'm one of the Deputy General Counsels for the Nevada System of Higher Education. I am co-presenting this agenda item with Maria Ducey-Paris, who is the University of Nevada Reno's Title IX Coordinator. She's joining us virtually from Reno. We are requesting your approval of proposed revisions to the Board of Regents Handbook, Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 13, titled Policy Against Unlawful Discrimination and Harassment Complaint Procedure, as contained in the supplemental agenda materials, which replaces the policy changes originally submitted in this agenda item. Since submission of the original proposed policy changes, there has been an important change to the federal Title IX law that should be reflected in board policy. Also, the team has further realized the need to align certain Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 13 timelines to existing timelines in Title II, Chapter 6 of the handbook, titled Rules and Disciplinary Procedures for Faculty, except DRI and Degree Revocations. This is crucial because Title II, Chapter 6 governs faculty contractual rights regarding employee discipline. These proposed policy changes, as well as others, will be more thoroughly discussed and presented to you by Maria later in our presentation. I realize time is really limited today, but I would be remiss if I did not recognize and publicly thank the team that's put countless hours into these proposed changes. First, my presenting teammate, Maria Ducey-Pree, Title IX Coordinator for University of Nevada, Reno, Mary Dugan, General Counsel for University of Nevada, Reno, and Deborah Peruska, Assistant General Counsel for University of Nevada, Las Vegas. As you are aware, the Nevada System of Higher Education's institutions must comply with Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. That's a federal law. Following drastic changes to Title IX in 2020, this board approved changes to the Board of Regents Handbook, Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 13, to align that policy with federal law. The changes we are presenting for your consideration today are primarily driven by the passage of State Senate Bill 327 and 347, as well as a new development in the federal Title IX law, which requires revising board policy again, as those laws, the state and federal laws, have evolved since August of 2020 when the board voted to approve the previous revisions. This is the first regularly scheduled board meeting since the passage of those state bills, as well as the first meeting since the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights has provided guidance regarding enforcement of a federal Title IX provision. To briefly detail the driving forces behind the proposals before you today, Senate Bill 327 amended state law to prohibit certain types of discrimination relating to race in employment and education. Senate Bill 347 added to state law certain provisions relating to sexual misconduct at institutions of higher education. And lastly, as previously mentioned, there's a new development in federal Title IX law, which will be more thoroughly discussed by Maria. But it broadens the scope of testimony that a hearing officer may consider at a live hearing regarding sexual harassment as afforded by federal law. Notably, our proposed changes do not address sections 12 through 15 of Senate Bill 347, and that's because development and implementation of the tools that are discussed in those sections are best suited for placement in the Policies and Guidelines Manual. For reference, section 12 and 12.5 refer and relate to the creation of a task force on sexual misconduct. The law statutorily created that task force, and yesterday this board took action to approve nominees, or to make appointments, rather, to that task force. Sections 13 through 15 of Senate Bill 347 relate to the development and implementation of a climate survey on sexual misconduct. The two universities have previously conducted climate surveys, but this is a really great opportunity to grow the climate survey process on our campuses. It's important to note that the federal Title IX laws are continuing to be in a state of evolution. The United States Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights has reminded us that it is undertaking a comprehensive review of the Title IX policies. Our team will continue to monitor and to review those developments and changes in law to ensure we're complying with all of the laws that govern sexual harassment and misconduct within the system. I'm now going to pass the time to Maria up in Reno so that she can further detail some of the substantive changes being presented before you today.
Aloha, Chair McAdoo, members of the board and presidents and others. I'm Maria Ducey-Pree, the Title IX coordinator at the University of Nevada, Reno. I want to start off, but before I jump into the changes, to just address one question that we have gotten as a committee as we looked at this. There are many people who are concerned that we're now before you doing these changes because there is a problem with our current policy. That is not the case. Our current policy is compliant with federal law. The difference, the reason we're here now, as my co-presenter alluded to, is because last year we focused on federal requirements and federal initiatives. This year, we're focusing on state initiatives. And so that's really the difference. Here, we've had some state changes and requirements that we are now implementing. And so I'll kind of walk through those for you. So the first one is the ENSHE non-discrimination statement. So now that statement has been modified so that it would add and incorporate hair texture and protective hairstyles into the protected class of race to conform with the definitions and protections afforded through SB 327, which is Nevada's Crown Act, creating a respectful and open world for natural hair. This change was made throughout the policy, so anywhere you'd see the language of our non-discrimination statement, it would now include that verbiage. The policy was also updated to include indecent exposure. As we implemented the definitions and misconduct that formulated sexual harassment last year, we did not include indecent exposure, although we thought that it was probably covered under the language that is there. Students requested that it be particularly included, and so when you have now specifically updated it to include that language. We've also added other definitions. There are two definition sections, and you might recall from last year when I talked about one policy, two processes. Well, we have two definition sections because we have the two processes, and we noticed that all of the definitions were used throughout, but they weren't defined in both sections. And so now we've remedied that by adding that to there. Also incorporated a new annual training requirement for all university or all campus law enforcement. And so that was necessary because there was a request that they were trained on trauma-informed processes and cultural awareness training and things along those lines. And so now these changes would implement that. The changes would also clarify some of the timelines to ensure that parties are informed of the conclusion and the decision in their matter. Another one that was added because of student request, amnesty language. This is not something that we've had within our policy before. Students requested that language be added that would encourage complainants and witnesses to report incidents of sexual harassment without fear of negative consequences for other student conduct policy violations that may have occurred at or around the same time as the reported sexual harassment. And so now that would be included within our policy. Along those same lines, there was a request that language be added that the respondent would be informed if a complainant indicated that I don't want an investigation into this matter, or specifically asked that that person not be disciplined, and that there was an investigation or other matters proceeded anyway, they would at least be informed that that was not because of the complainant's desires. Another provision that was added, and actually there are a couple of these, there are provisions that were added to afford students the right to share information as part of their assignments, as part of their overall learning experience, without fear of having an investigation initiated because of what they shared. There was a real interest in creating or implementing policy language that would give them that freedom of expression. So this provision, as well as a specific freedom of expression provision, were added to the policy. That freedom of expression provision also covers academic freedom, because we got a lot of questions about that as well. I think those cover most of the state initiatives that we were trying to incorporate. But that said, as was alluded to earlier, there have been some changes in federal law that also necessitated some changes. So one of the changes that we are recommending is a provision within the policy that says If there is a change or withdrawal or modification by the Department of Education of the laws that they have required that we have implemented within our policy, or if a federal court finds that a provision that was required by the Department of Education is unlawful, then our policy would then remove or revoke that specific provision automatically. And so we've added that language just because there is a lot of change in this area. Along those same lines, we recommended that change specifically because just last month, a federal court did just that and found a provision unlawful. In response, the Department of Education has indicated that they will not be enforcing that provision. And so we are recommending a change to align with federal law and those new changes. And I think those are all of the, there was one other substantial change, and it deals with timelines. As we review other policies, it was noted that the timelines that are identified for faculty member matters and hearings did not align with the same timelines under Title IX. So to ensure consistency across the board, we're now recommending that those timelines within this chapter be amended to align with the other timelines. Those are all of the substantive changes. Of course, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm prepared to make a motion, actually, on this recommended and proposed policy change. I would recommend approval of this particular item. I am looking at my notes after having reviewed. I think that our legal team and then obviously Title IX offices prepared a fabulous legal analysis as to why we need to make these particular changes by following both federal and state law. So I like that. I also want to commend our legal team in their legislative action that they took to shore up these particular changes and make sure they were consistent and compatible with our Nevada Administrative Code as well as our Nevada Revised Statutes. And finally, I think that the integration in terms of the recommended and proposed policy changes that are before us are appropriate. So with that, I can make a motion to approve, Madam Chair.
Regent McMichael second.
Regent McMichael seconded. Okay. Is there any discussion? Regent Perkins.
I have a few questions, if you don't mind, Madam Chair.
Please.
You mentioned the climate surveys at the colleges or universities. So that's at every institution? Or is that just at UNR and UNLV?
Madam Chair, Tina Ressam, through you to Regent Perkins. Climate surveys are something that Senate Bill 347 specifically wants implemented. And part of that was based upon student review and student input. That's not something we're asking to put into our policy because, as I mentioned, we believe that's something that should go into the policies and guidelines manual. However, the climate surveys, pursuant to the express language of 347, would permit the universities, well, actually, let me back up. There, portions of 347 create the individuals that will create the climate survey. So it would consist of researchers with specific education requirements, other individuals that have expertise in the field, as well as parameters of what type of questions should be included in that climate survey. That climate survey could be utilized at any institution. It would not be institution specific. The goal, of course, is to have safe and inclusive campuses for all. So if one of the smaller institutions do not have, say, those researchers, that they could then use one of the climate surveys developed by one of the universities.
Thank you. And a follow-up question, or another question, if I may. It was a lot of reading, and I just want to know if I missed it. Okay, at the institution level, if there's sexual harassment, is there a high, like if it doesn't get solved at the institution, is there some place to go? Does that victim or person have an option to go someplace else? And I don't know if I read it in there.
And in a moment, I'll be deferring to my colleague in Reno, but okay. First and foremost, on campuses, we are required to comply with Title IX, which subjects us to certain mandates that entitle an individual that's been subjected to sexual harassment or sexual misconduct certain opportunities to file a complaint or to receive supportive measures. That does not in any way preclude an individual from seeking to file a complaint outside, say in the criminal realm, filing a complaint with the police department, whether it's on campus or off campus. And then I'll be deferring to my colleague in Reno to further answer your question.
Can I? Oh, okay.
No,
go ahead.
Please feel free. Sorry.
Aloha. Again, Maria DeSapere for the record. As Ms. Weslam alluded to, the short answer to your question is yes, they can go outside of the campus. There are resources available. We actually publish those resources and make those resources available to each of our students, so they're aware of those resources. And one of the changes that I didn't go through, but that is included, requires that all complainants and respondents and parties be given a copy of the policy so that they can see those resources that are available to them. So they'll have that on hand and know what is available.
So if there's not, if there's not like satisfaction at the campus level, there in those documents, like, is there some place at the system level or, I mean, within our system that the person can go to? Or is that just, I'm just thinking out loud here. So is that what we're saying, that there is?
Not necessarily. Again, Maria DeSapere for the record. I'm not sure I'm completely following you, but I will take a stab at it. So we list out all of the resources that are available within NSHE. And so, and those resources are made available, obviously, to all of our students. That said, if they require additional resources, there are additional resources. For instance, there is a campus victim advocate that is a state or community resource, and that is available to all of our students. There are similar resources. And one of the things you may recall yesterday, the passage and creation of that task force, that's the purpose of that task force, is to have that more robust conversation to fully understand what the concerns are, if there are any gaps, how we can fill them, and how we can better service all of our students throughout Nevada.
That was exactly where I was trying to go. Thank you.
Yes.
Are there any other questions or comments? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? I vote aye as well. The motion passes. Thank you for your work on this. It is 1:30. We are going to take a 12-minute break. So 1:42, I'll see you back here. Okay, we're winding down. Or winding up. I'm not sure which. All right. We are now ready to take the consent items for the committees, starting with item number 27, going through item number 32. I would like to take those as a consent vote for all the committee reports. They have been emailed to all of us to have read and reviewed. So I would entertain a motion for that unless someone is wanting
approve.
To pull.
So that. Moved. Or second.
Okay, then. There we have it. Thank you. And I do want to double check, though. Nobody needs anything pulled from any of those committee reports, right? All right. So all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? I vote aye as well. The motion passes. Thank you very much for that. And we will now move to item number 33. And that is the authorization to draft an emergency policy amendments to require a COVID-19 vaccination for all NSHE employees. The board may take action to authorize the Office of the Chancellor to draft all policies and procedures, including emergency amendments to the code, handbook, and procedures and guidelines manual that are necessary to implement and enforce a mandate that all NSHE employees, including but not limited to all academic and administrative faculty, and irrespective of job title or tenure status, be required to complete a COVID-19 vaccination series on or before December 1st, 2021. Any policies, procedures, and amendments drafted by the Office of the Chancellor pursuant to this authorization will be submitted to the board for final approval at a publicly noticed special meeting of the board.
Motion to approve.
Okay. Looking for a second.
I will second.
Madam Chair?
And yes. Yes, Regent Geddes.
I would like to expand on that motion, if it's okay with the first and second, or offer to expand
please
on it.
Please go ahead and offer the expansion, and then the first and second can accept the friendly amendment, I guess, is what you're offering us. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm just trying to expand and get some more detail and direction into it.
Yeah, I would like to have clarity, too, on the exact wording of the motion. Thank you.
And I would like the motioner and the second to authorize the Office of the Chancellor to draft new emergency policies. And, of course, my computer froze. There we go. And procedures in the code or handbook or procedures and guidelines manual that are necessary to mandate the ARB and all NESHI employees, including all faculty, classified staff, adjunct professors, and letters of appointment employees, irrespective of tenure status, working on campus or remotely, to receive a complete COVID-19 vaccination series on or before December 1st, 2021, or be subject to expedited discipline. Including in this motion is a request to include the religious and medical exemptions, and that the amendments be brought back to the board by October 1st.
All right. Regent McMichael, are you good with the motion as it's worded by Regent Geddes?
Yes.
And the second was?
That was me. And I will accept that amendment. Thank you.
Regent Carvalho. Okay. And I want
to.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Regent.
Well, I just want to make a comment in support of that.
Okay.
And we've got some public comment in favor and against. And I just want to say, you know, the World Health Organization, the CDC, the American Medical Association, the American Pediatric Association, the State Board of Health, Governor's Medical Advisory Team, and our own NESHI Task Force have all recommended this action. We have mandated for the students by November 1st. So I think this is a very reasonable mandate, and that we should get behind the public health effort for our students, faculty, staff, and the communities in which we reside. And I encourage everybody to support that motion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Regent Dubrava.
Thank you, Chair McAdoo. I just also want to lend my support to this motion and this endeavor. It just comes down to it's good medicine, it's good public policy, good public health policy, and I strongly support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other? Regent Tarkanian?
And Chair?
Yes.
Does all this include ramifications such as what happens to the salary of someone who is now on staff if they don't have the shot and don't take it? Are they then released? Who's their salary for the year? We're giving them no time to look for another job or anything.
So
I wonder.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I agree with you and one other member. I'm having a hard time. I keep getting ladies into this conversation somehow through technology. But in any case, you and someone else questioned some of the things pertaining to this, and I know that you support it, but I just wonder, as everybody, there's nothing in the motion. Are the people protected who signed but did not know this would happen? They wouldn't be able to get it.
So I understand your question. I just want to clarify that this is really the only authorizing the development of the policy, so the policy itself would have the results of no vaccination or that. Is that correct, Council Reynolds?
Joe Reynolds, for the record, that is correct, Chair McAdoo. Though I would state before the board that consistent with Regent Getty's clarification of Regent McMichael's motion, that expedited discipline would be authorized. And at the end of the day, my advice would be that if something is truly a mandate, that noncompliance would ultimately result in termination of the employee.
You're saying that will be clarified later when we get into more of the specifics?
Yes, when the policy comes back to us, we will all have the opportunity to look that policy over, read it, be familiar with it, and know that there will be, I'm sure there will be something in there that's not followed.
That's all right. Thank you very much for the clarification.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question. Regent Perkins?
Just something to add to the consideration of the policy. Since it's an emergency, if the infection rate goes below a certain percentage, can that be included in there also that it's no longer mandatory? And the other one is like an alternative, some more detail about alternatives if you choose the religious or the medical exemption, something that says, you know, that you're tested once a week, that you're tested every 10 days, or, you know, something along those lines. So just to make some clarification into the policy, like when we get it, so.
Okay. Go ahead.
Joe Reynolds, for the record. Thank you, Regent Perkins. Regent Brooks and I discussed this morning at the Health Science Committee, it's my legal advice that both religious exemptions and medical exemptions be recognized in any mandate. If one of those exemptions is approved and authorized, there will be accommodations and mitigation restrictions still required of any individuals. I would note any mandate would be brought under emergency Title II code provisions that the board is authorized to enact. Those code provisions would be effective for 120 days, at which time they would need to come back to the board for more permanent authorization.
Thank you for that.
Chair McAdoo, I just have one.
Yes,
question.
Regent Brooks.
What I'm wondering is considerations for the policy itself, and kind of in line with what Regent Perkins was talking about. The students already have a policy that was generated by the Nevada Board of Health. And what I don't think would be in best practice is to have almost two different generated policies in terms of splitting up policy for students and then policy for staff, faculty, to anybody else who may be on the campus. And so I'm wondering if there is going to be some type of policy for mandated vaccines for teachers, staff, and everyone else, but in that are going to be considerations specifically for not only the exemptions but possible testing, that it almost feels like that would have to be worked in with this for the students as well. And so I don't know that it feels like we're almost like dividing things up in terms of policy that is now generated by the Nevada Board of Health and then new policy that will be generated for others. And so what I'm trying to figure out is, again, if there's going to be, and maybe it could be something added to the motion or recognize that there could be a tweak to this for students under the Nevada Board of Health policy for the mandate, right? That if there's if there's any room for anything, any give for faculty, staff, and everybody else, support elements, that would also be applied to the students as well.
Joe Reynolds, for the record, with respect to, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding the question, with respect to a religious or a medical exemption, those are the exemptions that are recognized in NAC 441A by the State Board of Health that also would apply to students in the vaccination requirement. It's my legal recommendation that any policy adopted by this board also recognize and include those two exemptions, and that it would still be a mandate, a requirement. The legal framework of those, though, are different, in that this is the Board of Regents as the employer of all NCHE employees. At the end of the day, can set terms and conditions of employment. And that this would be one of those as a policy that would apply to all employees. I'm not sure.
No, I think that, thank you, Mr. Reynolds. So that makes sense. So then if part of the policy is going to be taking a look at consideration for the tick marks of 70%, right, where after you've achieved 70%, there may be some room that we don't have to have a mandate because those goals have already been met. And if those goals have already been met through faculty, staff, and support elements, then that would mean that those goals have been met regarding students as well. And so I guess that's kind of like where I'm going with this, where I just want to make sure there's no division, even though we're talking about faculty and staff, that there's no real hard line between students and what's going to be expected of them while they're on campus, and then faculty, staff, and support elements, their expectation while they're on campus, so that essentially it's the same.
No, thank you, and I think I understand that at least contemplated in the motion before the board, there's not a 70% threshold. The 70% threshold is something that was directed through Governor Sisolak's testing requirement for all state employees. The motion that's before the board is an absolute mandate, so that it would require a COVID vaccination series for all employees, and I would add all administrative, academic, faculty, classified employees, adjunct professors, post-secondary, or postdoctorate, employees, graduate assistants, student workers, everyone who receives a paycheck from NCHE for work. And the overriding intent and the December 1st date is that's often when letters of appointment contracts go out for the spring 2022 semester. And I believe that the intent of the State Board of Health's amendments and regulations for students was that every student in an NCHE classroom in person is vaccinated. The intent, as I understand from the board and the motion on the table, would be the same, that every employee, every faculty member that is working for NCHE be vaccinated, so that we have a safe and healthy classroom for all our students and all our employees.
Got it. So the way that I understand you're taking a look at this is that it already is going to be universal. There is no distinction then between whether you're a student or a faculty member or somebody who's contracted to come into the university to get some work done. Everybody's on the same page.
Yes. Though my recommendation, if the board authorizes this, yes, it would be certainly universal. My recommendation, though, would also be that it apply to employees whether they're working remotely telecommuting or whether they're in person, that top to bottom, it's 100% mandate, except for those two exceptions, and that if an employee applies for those exceptions, that those be given diligent scrutiny. They are narrow exceptions, and even if an exception is granted, that it will only be able to do so with accommodations and limitations, because again, the goal is to make sure that there is 100% safety to the best of our ability in a classroom. And that would at least be, if we're charged to draft those policies, it would be those would be provisions that I would recommend.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you, Chair McAdoo.
Thank you for the questions.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Regent Boylan.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate it. And this question is for Councillor Reynolds, and it may seem like I missed something, but I'm not religious, but from my father's side, I'm Irish Catholic, and from my mother's side, I'm Jewish. So what if I just decide to say, because of my religious beliefs, I don't want to take the shot? Then how does that work? Can anybody, we say on one hand that this is for everybody, whoever gets a paycheck, but then there's exceptions, and I'm sure, I know you're going to say it's maybe the government has allowed it or something, but Councillor Reynolds usually has a very good explanation for this. So maybe someone comes along and says, I'm from the religion of Joe Shack, the minor or something, I don't know. And he says, I don't take it. How do we handle that? Just for my, I'm sure there is a way that you've thought about this, but I'm really, really interested and curious as to why we make exceptions always. On one hand, we'll say everybody, no, but this one. So please explain that to me, sir.
Joe Reynolds, for the record, certainly Regent Boylan. The religious exemption is something that is recognized by the United States Supreme Court, and it's also, I'd say, something that is recognized already in Nevada law as it pertains to the student mandate. That there's already a precedent in Nevada law for a religious exemption. The standard is a sincerely held religious belief. And, there's difficulty sometimes in interpreting what that means. When you get into someone's religion, naturally, someone's faith, what's in someone's head, heart, and spirituality can be difficult to measure. Something that I am aware of, though, it is, or at least I'm not aware of any of major recognized religions having any kind of doctrine that would prohibit or go against an individual who is a member of that church to receiving the vaccination, whether it's Judaism, Catholicism, Protestant, Presbyterian, any of the major religions, LDS, I'm not aware of that. And so the intent would certainly be that this is a narrow exception, but also one that can be validly raised. I've been discussing with all the general councils of the institutions, taking a look at this as well as national trends, and are certainly concerned to make sure that this isn't a exception that is overused or frivolously used or claimed by someone. And again, I would note that it's sincerely held. That's the standard, not just that somebody doesn't want to do it, not that an objection to the legality of it or they disagree with the medicine and science behind it. It has to be something that is a core tenet of their faith. And I would also add to the prior conversation, even if one of those exemptions was granted, there is still accommodations and mitigation measures that any individual would be subject to. Some of those, and it would be reviewed on by a case-by-case basis, but I can imagine they would include face coverings, weekly testing, and things of that sort. At the end of the day, though, if reasonable accommodations can't be put into place for a specific individual, there's still, at the end of the day, the possibility of a loss of employment. And I just don't want at this point to start speculating on all those, because a lot of them do get very much fact-specific.
Oh, thanks so much. But so we do have a thing where we will look into someone who says, I'm not doing it, because then that person isn't vaccinated. So do we have a process at the universe, at NSHI? Have we thought about that part? And just... I'm sure you have, because You like a chess player, you think way ahead, I've noticed. So have we thought about something like that?
Joe Reynolds, for the record, absolutely. We've been thinking about that, but I would also add, we're in new territory, and the Board of Regents has never done this before. If you look at our 1,000-plus pages in our code and handbook and procedure and guidelines manual, the word vaccine isn't anywhere. The roadmap has been set forth by the State Board of Health, in that we certainly had a regulatory roadmap in the regulations. And I just note for anyone listening that there is a storm brewing outside. I apologize.
The storm is already brewed. All right. Let's see. Regent Geddes, I believe I had text from you. I'm sorry. Regent Boylan, did you have another question?
No, ma'am. I was just thanking Mr. Reynolds because he's always got a good explanation.
Yes. Yes, thank you.
Yes, there's a nice storm.
Thank you. Yep. Regent Geddes, can you hear me over the storm?
Yes, and the storm sounds glorious. I wish I was in the rain.
I'm thankful for the rain.
I just wanted to ask Chancellor Rose. I know we don't have a formal policy before us, but I just want to make sure that she was supportive of this recommendation and the development of the policy.
Thank you. Chancellor Rose, please.
Chair McAdoo, Vice Chair Carter, members of the Board of Regents, to you and through you, Madam Chair, to Regent Geddes, for the record, Chancellor Rose. I'll take a few moments in this quiet in the storm. Appreciate the question very much, Regent Geddes. In short, I recommend passage of the motion, but I'd like to share a few thoughts since you've asked me the question. I believe vaccinating requirements for all NC faculty and staff who are not eligible for the medical or religious exemptions is necessary to our collective health and to maintaining in-person learning. This position is consistent with my previous public statements on the matter, particularly with respect to our fidelity to science, safety, and national best practices. As Dr. Hugh English reminded us this morning, the data repeatedly affirm that vaccines are our best tool in the fight against COVID-19 and therefore provide our best opportunity to both protect the health and safety of our communities and to ensure in-person, high-quality learning. Finally, this requirement is only fair, given that the State Board of Health voted to require in-person students at our institutions to be vaccinated in order to enroll next semester. Having discussed this matter multiple times with our 8 wonderful presidents, I also want to recognize that we understand this matter will be controversial and will have consequences that may present some challenges, and I think it is right and proper to acknowledge those as well. Some of our institutions are understandably concerned about employees who may voluntarily separate based on this requirement. And the fact that the emergency policy change means a quick policy development and implementation plan, you know, provides certain implementation challenges, but we will rise to those challenges. In the face of these challenges, I recommend board approval of item 33. And of course, because I deeply value and respect the principles of input from all of our stakeholders, my team has already prepared a stakeholder input process, which we will expedite should this item pass. We will expedite immediately next week so that we can take input on a policy adoption. So again, Regent Geddes, I thank you for the question. I thank you for asking for my thoughts on this. And my staff and I, of course, as always, are happy to respond to any questions regarding process or next steps as they may be necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor
Thank
Rose.
You.
And thank you, Regent Geddes. Regent Carter.
I just have a, I guess, clarifying question. I think I heard Regent Brooks make a comment. I just wanted to make sure that this was correct or noted, that there are contractors in, like, food services and the bookstore and things like that that this would not apply to. So it wouldn't be, I think the comment was everybody on our campus. So it wouldn't be everybody on our campus. Is that correct, Councilor?
Thank you, Vice Chair Carter, Joe Reynolds, for the record. With respect to independent contractors, as opposed to individuals that receive actual paychecks from INCHI, my proposal would be to the board to have a provision that any new contracts that are in or into going forward include provisions that, as a requirement for the contract, that any employees of the contractor also be required to be fully vaccinated in order to perform work or the contract services on any of our campuses.
Vice Chair Carter, I do know that you are my vice chair as well as a regent. My apologies for not referring to you as that. All right.
Chair McAdoo, I just have a follow-up question for Mr. Reynolds, and that's the same question that I posed earlier about liability. And it seems like it looks differently now than it did earlier in that if it's part of policy for employees and an employee then has an adverse reaction to the vaccine, then would that not fall – who would that fall onto in terms of the liability?
Joe Reynolds, for the record, again, I want to be careful not too much to opine, but at the end of the day, there is a choice. Whether you work somewhere, you have a personal choice to decide where you work, what job you take, what profession you enter into, and if an employee makes their own choice that they don't want to comply with this policy change, just like any policy that the board may enact, they can work somewhere else. I mean, that's my recommendation. And at the end of the day, that the board and INCHI would not be liable for that choice. And I would defend any lawsuits that are brought by any individuals on that basis vigorously.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. I guess to that, I could only assume that through many conversations that the presidents of the universities have probably shared with the chancellor, that those considerations have already been accounted for in terms of the potential loss of staff members or faculty members that may not want to be mandated to take a vaccine, and they may choose to do something different. I guess as long as the consideration then is that the presidents are very comfortable with recognizing that there could be a loss of staff, and if they are, then those conversations, I guess, have already taken place. And to me, the communication about this is pretty important in terms of what this looks like for the institution should these policies develop.
Joe Reynolds, for the record. The intent, I believe, of the board's motion to today is, to give the authorization to develop those policies in a very short timeline, bring the specifics back to the board, I think, in a very short timeline for the board to read the details, for lack of a better word, and approve those. There will be a second meeting by the board on this matter before anything would become effective.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Chair McAdoo, I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Arascata.
Thank you. Mr. Reynolds, if this does get approved, what's your time frame for having all the documentation and everything prepared for us? Or disseminated to us?
I'll defer to Chair McAdoo.
If this passes today, I will be calling a special board meeting on September 30th at 9 o'clock in the morning to discuss, deliberate, and decide on the policy.
And I would add Regent Ariscotta to that. As Chancellor Rose just mentioned, there is already a plan that under her guidance and leadership that we have put in place to engage in an expedited stakeholder input process that would begin mid-next week.
So obviously, General Counsel and the Chancellor and the Chair and Vice Chair, I mean, we put together a timeline, and the reason I emphasized if is I want you to know that I didn't come with any preconceived idea of what would happen with this. So I'm prepared either way. If it didn't pass, I'm also prepared for a special board meeting in regard to what would happen without the passage. So I just wanted to make that clear. Vice Chair Carter.
So I do have, I guess, a friendly amendment or a question, if you will. So I believe in the motion that October 1st was the deadline for having the policy. So if the meeting is in mind for the 30th, the motion might need to be changed to be earlier than the 30th for that to come back to the board.
If Joe Reynolds, for the record, if I can clarify at least the understanding to Vice Chair Carter, I and Regent Geddes, please correct me if I'm wrong. The October 1st deadline, as I would understand it, is for a board meeting to occur prior to October 1st, and so that would be a deadline for board action, for lack of a better word.
Was that your understanding of the motion, Regent Geddes, that the meeting would occur before October 1st?
Yes, Chair McAdoo, that was my understanding.
Thank you. All right. Does that? All right. Do you have further question, Regent Ariscotta? No. Okay. I see no more comments or questions, so I'm going to call for a roll call vote. Please, Carrie.
Regent Boylan.
Aye.
Regent Brooks.
Yes.
Vice Chair Carter.
Yes.
Regent Carvalho.
Aye.
Regent Del Carlo.
Aye.
Regent Dubrava.
Yes.
Regent Geddes.
Aye.
Chair McAdoo.
Yes.
Regent McMichael.
Yes.
Regent Moran. Regent Perkins.
Aye.
Regent Tarkanian?
Aye.
Regent Ariscotta?
Yes.
Motion passes unanimously.
Okay. So I want to say thank you. Really, thank you for the discussion and the deliberation and meetings with presidents by individual regents prior to. I appreciate all of that, and so now I get to do one of my favorite things, and that's go through a little list here of thank yous. And so certainly, President Acharya, we can't thank you enough for hosting the meeting. You've been a gracious host. Your staff has, they've got customer service down pat besides research. So thank you so much. And for our campus partners, Iris Stewart, Paul Pate, Jerry Derby, Tom Giuliano, Britt McManus Chapman, Allie Swallow, Deidre Page, and Tracy Bauer, we thank you. Our audio visual people, Rick Romero and Claudio Osanyaga. I came in the other morning way early, and seriously, I could not believe all the boxes of all this equipment and how much work that you put into getting this set up. So thank you. And for our SCS staff, Brian Anzalone, James Unfried, Bentley Holmes Goal, Ed Boog, Gar Casal, CC Periolis, Tim Shupp, thank you. The catering, I've already said, was the best. And that would have been Jean-Pierre Guiron, and he's with the Art of Cooking. And the University Police Services. well, I don't even know if there are really words to describe all that you did to make this meeting especially safe, and not just our lives, but the building and just all the work you've done. So thank you for that. Thank you, Chancellor Rose, and thank you, General Counsel Reynolds, and the board staff, and my fellow regents, and the presidents, and the students, and everyone behind you. It is sincerely my pleasure to call you friends and colleagues and to get to work with you, make these important decisions about higher education. I'm honored to get to do that. And now, I hope I didn't leave anybody out. That's the problem with thank yous, I guess. we will move to new business. And so I've already announced that we will have the special board meeting on September 30th at 9 o'clock. That afternoon at 3 o'clock, we have an investment committee. And so it seemed like good timing for that. And I know that Chancellor Rose has done all her preparation work to get that ready, as well as General Counsel Reynolds. Regent McMichael, you asked me to give a new business item, please.
Yes, and I need clarification from Counsel Reynolds. At present, do we have any measures to combat individuals who are bringing in false vaccine cards?
Respectfully, Regent McMichaels, just because this is a new business agenda item, that it's proper just for regents to raise new business matters for consideration at a future board meeting. But I'd certainly be happy to discuss that with you after the meeting.
Are you requesting that as a new business item?
Yes.
Okay.
At present, I don't think we've are dealing with anyone who are presenting these fraudulent cards.
So, Regent McMichael, if I can just say that, can I just add the fake ID cards for vaccinations to the new business?
Yes.
And then if that gets on an agenda, then would be the time to discuss it. Is that all right?
That would be first.
Okay.
Perfect.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Regent Brooks, I have you as a new business item.
What I wanted to bring up, Chair McAdoo, was under new business for not the special meeting, but a regular meeting, whenever that sits on calendar, is the possibility of the Board of Regents essentially hiring a director of communications that would specifically fall under General Counsel and Chief of Staff of the Board of Regents.
Okay. All right. All right. Is there any other new business? No new business. Then we will move to public comment. Is there public comment in ELCO?
Madam Chair, there is no public comment in ELCO at this
time. All right. Is there public comment in Reno?
No, there is not, Chair McAdoo.
All right. Is there public comment in Las Vegas? Thank you. And is there written public comment?
Yes, there is.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. The first comment is from Angela Ash. Earlier, Jay Reynolds said college students make the choice to go to college and therefore have no choice but to comply and are personally liable for any and all adverse reactions to the vaccines. Research is showing young men are 6 times more likely to suffer heart problems after the vaccine. Research is showing mutations are not slowed by the presence of the vaccine. Why the rush to mandate when states like West Virginia are reporting 25% increase in deaths for the vaccinated and 21% increase in breakthrough cases, August 23, 2021? What will members of the Board of Regents tell constituents when the virus fails to respond to this mandate? The last public comment is from Mason Van Howling, CEO of UMC. Dr. Michael Gardner made several claims at today's meeting and in the past regarding UNLV Health's financial shortfall, placing much of the blame on uncompensated care at UMC. There is much more to this financial picture than uncompensated care. It seems that UNLV Health is always looking for others to help solve the organization's fundamental business deficiencies. UMC and Clark County have supported UNLV Medicine since its inception, including offering 10 acres of high-value land for the medical school building currently under construction. Every dollar given to UMC by CMS to cover the costs associated with academic medicine is provided fully to UNLV, including UMC's allocation. Furthermore, UMC currently operates at $8 million over the allotted cap for direct and indirect medical education expenses. Uncompensated care only represents a small portion of UNLV's business at UMC. UNLV occupies many of the highest revenue-generating service lines at UMC, including trauma, surgical services, and burn. To ensure fair compensation for UNLV Health, UMC's professional service agreements take into account UMC's payer mix. Within these contracts, UMC provides additional funds to offset uncompensated care. UNLV's challenges come as a result of Nevada's economy, not UMC. Nevada has the second highest unemployment rate in the nation, and the state's Medicaid enrollment recently increased by 20%, or 300,000 people. These are typical healthcare challenges. Among uninsured patients at UMC, the hospital successfully converts 90% of these individuals to reimbursement sources. The excuse of uncompensated care that you heard this morning is an attempt to absolve UNLV Health of any financial responsibility. Rather than placing the blame squarely on UMC, the organization should focus instead on following basic healthcare principles, including timely and proper patient scheduling, access billing, and collections. I welcome you to contact me directly to discuss this matter. That concludes public comment.
Thank you for your fine reading of public comment. I'm very impressed that you can read that without a lot of emphasis on any words, so thank you. All right, this adjourns the meeting. Thank you.